This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Since I'm the course co-chair, I gave my other chairperson the night off, so I'm here to introduce myself. My name is Karen Sun. I am an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics here. And I started my training, I did my undergraduate training at Yale, and then went to Case Western for medical school in Cleveland, Ohio. And then I did my residency in pediatrics here at UCSF. I went and worked at Denver Children's Hospital for a few years and then came back here in 2008. Currently, I'm the chief of the Division of Pediatric Hospital Medicine and also the associate director of our inpatient pain palliative and sedation program. So today, the topic I'm going to be discussing is bringing pain relief to children, exploring old and new treatment strategies. And this is just a general overview of what I'll be discussing today. So first, I'm just going to talk in general about what pain is, the physiology of pain, discuss how not all pain is the same, and that's sort of a way to think about targeting different treatment modalities for pain. And then just a little discussion on how children are not the same as adults. You know, as pediatricians, that's something we really focus on, and the way that kids process pain, the way that we treat pain in kids is also, there are some differences between our strategies and our approach to the treatment of pain. And then there are a lot of myths about kids in pain that I want to talk about and sort of dispel some of those myths. I'm going to talk a little about the importance of a good assessment of pain, not just for kids, but also for adults, and how that affects our treatment. And then also the variety of different treatment options, the ways that we use to relieve pain, both inpatient and outpatient, not focusing just on drugs, but also non-pharmacologic ways that we can use now to treat pain, and also some interventional ways. And then also at the end, I'm just going to briefly touch on some promising research that's going on, new ways that we've learned to treat pain. So first of all, what is pain? Pain is described as, I thought this was a really good description, it's an uncomfortable sensation or feeling, and it is such an important factor in health that it has been called the fifth vital sign. So, you know, in medicine, we talk about the four vital signs, the heart rate, the blood pressure, your respiratory rate, your temperature, and really pain should be a part of any assessment that you do. And if you don't properly assess pain, then you may not properly treat your patient or properly treat, figure out exactly what you need to do to make your patient better or to make yourself better or kids. So what is pain? Pain is really a protective response. It's a signal that something is wrong. So, you know, if you have a fire if there's a stimulus that's, your body needs to react to, then the neurons, so this is the basic transmission of information to the brain is through the cell called the neuron. And so it goes up through, this is the spinal thalamic tract in the spinal cord, up into the thalamus, up into the cerebrum, where it's processed. And all of our perceptions of pain, there's a lot of different factors that modulate our perception of pain, happen up here. And then there are pathways that go back down through the spinal cord into the finger, and some of it's motor telling you to retract from the pain. And there's a lot of different responses that occur. But normally, pain is actually, we need pain, right? If we didn't have pain, then we wouldn't be able to react to abnormal or noxious stimuli. But everybody experiences pain differently. So, you know, the only person that can really describe and tell you about your pain is really the person themselves. And everyone has different pain thresholds. The way that we perceive pain is modulated by a large number of different factors. Some people become very stoic. They turn internally. Other people externalize. And it's very different from one person to the next. And that's why a pain assessment is so important, because you can't just look at one factor. You have to look at a lot of different factors. So these are some of the things that modulate the way that we perceive pain. Personality characteristics, their different coping mechanisms, how your family has responded to pain in the past. You know, there are certain cultural attitudes toward pain that will really direct how someone perceives how much pain they're in, how much they ask for medication and treatment. Your past pain experiences are really extremely important. If you've been sensitized to pain, if you've had a very bad experience, especially with kids, that will definitely change the way that you perceive future pain, any painful things. The circumstances that happen at the time of any kind of tissue damage. An analogy that I use with some of my patients is if you stub your toe when you're walking on the beach and you're doing something really fun, then that pain is going to be perceived very differently than if you stub your toe taking the trash out for your mom, right? It's very different because the circumstances around that experience will really, you know, it all happens up here and your higher level of functioning will change the way that you perceive that pain. So there's a lot of different factors that go in. Obviously, the amount of tissue damage is going to affect the degree of pain. And then the presence or absence of chronic pain or intractable pain, you know, as pain mounts on top of itself, you're going to get different responses and different degrees of pain. And then also how much your pain behavior is reinforced. And this is particularly important in the pediatric population. You know, we see a lot of kids that are in the hospital a lot. There's a lot of things that happen to kids, and how that painful behavior is reinforced by the parents can really have effect on sort of future pain experiences. There are different types of pain, and I really kind of try to separate them into two different categories. There's the clinical type of pain, so there's acute and chronic, and I'll go into a little bit about sort of the differences between those two. And then there's a physiologic, so how your body transmits the pain and what's the actual biologic mechanism that's going on, what's the pathophysiology that's going on. There's nociceptive pain and there's neuropathic pain, and I'll talk a little bit about the differences between those two. So acute and chronic, I mean, some of this is sort of intuitive, but acute pain is usually self-limited, and it's usually a response to some sort of stimuli, like a burn or you fall, and it's a warning system to your body to react in a certain way, and it's often associated with a high level of anxiety around that pain. Usually acute pain is controlled well by analgesics, you know, medicines that we commonly think about as being good pain relievers, Tylenol, ibuprofen, you know, our narcotics. And it's really easily scored in the sense that it's really easy for a person to tell me if on a scale of 1 to 10, my pain is an 8. That's typical of acute pain. Chronic pain is different in that it's sort of self-perpetuating, and there's really no apparent purpose sometimes to the pain. And generally, instead of anxiety, it sort of leads to this overall feeling of depression. And oftentimes, analgesics, narcotics, Tylenol, all of those medications don't seem to work as well. And it's also difficult for patients to describe their pain. It's been ongoing for so long. When you ask them to score that pain, it's very difficult for them to give you a real number. So there's a lot of differences, and it also changes the way that you're going to approach and target your treatment plan for them. Chronic pain usually doesn't have a really defined temporal onset, in the sense that really sometimes it's hard for people to describe when actually this pain happened. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes like, oh, you know, I strained my back. You know, I had this one incident where I fell off a horse or whatever, and that's when everything started. But a lot of times it doesn't happen that way. And if chronic pain has been going on for many, many months to years, then that's really going to be the typical history that you get. And also there may be signs of some autonomic nervous system hyperactivity. So you may find that these they're very hypersensitive, and so their whole body is sort of revved up around painful experiences. It is often associated with depression. I mean, the mind-body experience goes hand in hand, and over time, I mean, if you think about somebody who's had to deal with chronic pain for many, many years, clearly that's going to affect their level of activity, the ability to interact with your peers, going to school, all of those things, and that can obviously lead to depression. Oftentimes, the underlying cause is not treatable in the sense that it's not like you had appendicitis and you got your appendix taken out. Surgery doesn't fix it. It's a long, chronic process that requires what we call a multimodal treatment plan. So you have to use a variety of different techniques in order to sort of achieve some level of pain control for these patients. And then what about the pathophysiologic differences between pain? So we talked about the nociceptive and the neuropathic. So the nociceptive is really what I'm talking about with acute pain. So it's the expected result of tissue injury. So you have acute tissue injury or acute inflammation, and you have normal neural transmission. So the neurons are firing appropriately. They are sending signals to the brain. There's a correct amount of inhibitory pathways coming down to the brain telling you to modulate the pain. It's usually very localized, and it usually resolves with healing. As the inflammation heals, as the initial insult, whatever it was, heals, then the pain goes away. Neuropathic pain is what happens when the actual problem is in the nervous system itself. So the primary lesion or the primary dysfunction is at the level of the neuron. And so what happens is the pain persists independent of ongoing tissue injury or inflammation. So the initial insult is gone. The inflammation's gone. You know, everything's been fixed. You can't find anything wrong on any kind of imaging or scan, but the nerves themselves have changed. They've changed in a way that they're abnormally transmitting pain signals when there actually isn't a painful stimulus there anymore. And this is what leads to this chronic, intractable pain. Oftentimes, the initial insult is nociceptive, right? So, you sprain your ankle and the ankle heals. And so the nociceptive pain part goes away, but then you're left with neuropathic pain. And that's what we sometimes see. There's this thing called chronic complex regional pain syndrome, CRPS, and that's where people get very hypersensitized nerves. And this doesn't happen necessarily in a limb. It can happen in the abdomen. It can happen anywhere in the body. It's really just the primary problem is in the nerves itself and their ability to transmit pain. They're just very hyperexcitable. So this is just, again, so this is nociceptive pain. So the pain, this is correct neural transmission. You have your nerve out in the sensory, like say your finger, you have pain. It transmits through this neuron into the spinal cord. This is the dorsal root ganglion, which is part of the spinal cord. And the pain signals go up to the thalamus. And then it's processed and in the cortex. And then there are these descending inhibition. So your body can actually produce what we call endogenous opioids. So your body has the ability to actually produce its own pain reliever. And this comes down through here. It inhibits the transmission of pain that's coming through to here. So it modulates your pain. So you have your body has its own internal way of decreasing pain, decreasing those pain signals. And that's nociceptive pain. And that's sort of the neurons, the body is functioning, it's functioning properly. In neuropathic pain, what happens is, first of all, out here, there's increased sensitivity in these nerves. These are your afferent nerves, the nerves that bring the signals to the brain. And so non-painful stimuli can now be perceived as painful. And then you also get hyperexcitability of this dorsal root ganglion. So these nerves are much more excitable, and so they just shoot these pain signals up much more rapidly than you would normally see in a normal pain transmission. And then you also see loss of these neurons coming down that usually inhibit pain and decrease the amount of pain that you're seeing. So with neuropathic pain, there's a lot of different things that can go on that will change the way that pain is processed in the brain. these are the characteristics of neuropathic pain. Very, very painful. But the pain is described very differently. It's lancinating, so very sharp, like a stabbing, like a knife stab sometimes. And paroxysmal, meaning it's very sudden. It can be described as very burning, and it's a very constant pain. There's cramping, there's aching, and there's this thing, and I'll talk about sort of hyperalgesia, allodynia, and hyperpathia. And these are some of the ways that we would characterize what we describe as classic neuropathic pain. So this is sort of how the body responds. So if you have a stimulus intensity, so this is increasing painful stimulus. So like, say you have increasing heat or increasing something that's causing pain to the body. And then this is your magnitude of pain, the degree of pain that is being caused. Normally, as this increasing stimulus intensity, you get this linear curve of the magnitude of pain as you get more painful stimulus. With hyperalgesia, you have a lower pain threshold. So lower stimulus intensity will cause pain. And then this, so sometimes you don't need as much pain to a stimulus intensity to cause the same degree of pain. And then there's allodynia. So allodynia means that it's not actually a painful stimuli, can cause extreme excruciating pain. So in these patients, they can't even have the sheets on their bed on top of them. They can't have a fan blowing on them because that will cause excruciating pain. So it's really pain out of proportion. There's no painful stimulus at all, but they are perceiving significant amount of pain. And then hyperpathia. So they have a higher pain threshold. This is, can happen, occur when there's actual nerve damage, nerve loss. They have a very high pain threshold, but then when there is this painful stimulus, their pain is extremely, extremely excruciating painful. And these are very commonly seen in patients that have neuropathic pain. Oftentimes with neuropathic pain, you can find there are abnormal findings on your physical exam. So I see sometimes swelling of the limb that's affected. So this person's left arm, he has neuropathic pain. There's increased hair growth. Sometimes there's color changes and temperature changes. So that limb will be more blue or much cooler than the other extremity. And that just happens with chronic neuropathic pain. So I'll go on a little bit later when we talk about treatments, just so that keep in mind these two different kinds of pain, because we'll talk about sort of the treatment options that we have for them. I want to talk a little bit now about some of the myths around children specifically and pain. So the first myth is that children's behaviors will reflect their pain intensity. This is not true. So we think, you know, oh, kids, if they're crying, they're having pain. Children in pain may become very quiet and very still, like tuning out. You know, they're just kind of really sitting there in their bed. I teach on the wards, and I've had residents that are still learning and training come and say, oh, their pain's great. They're not, you know, they're just sitting really quietly in bed. And then you go into the room and you see the patient is just basically locked in, you know, very, very quiet, not crying, but just won't even move because they're in so much pain. And so you can't really necessarily judge based on what they're externally showing. They may sleep a lot. And then there are some kids that continue to play. Kids are amazing at self-directed distraction. And we use that to our advantage a lot. But kids, they want to play. They want to be well. And so they can really distract themselves from the pain that they're having. Another myth is that small children, especially infants, will tolerate pain much better. I think this is changing. People are becoming much more knowledgeable about pain and what causes pain, and especially in young infants. But we know now that pain receptors are present by 20 weeks of gestation, and then complete myelination of the pain pathways occurs by 37 weeks. So myelination is sort of the covering or the sheath of the neurons that help transmit pain much more quickly. But it's the inhibitory pathways that develop later. So they actually may experience more pain because those inhibitory pathways that sort of help to modulate pain don't develop until much later in infants. So there was a boy in 1985 that basically changed the way that we perceive and the way that we treat pain in young infants. So this boy, Jeffrey Lawson, he underwent open heart surgery. And during that time, they didn't use any anesthesia or any pain medicine They only used a muscle relaxant, so something that basically paralyzed him so that he couldn't move, but they didn't treat him with any pain. And when his mom found out about it, she basically raised, it was a standard of care back then. You know, they didn't think that the kids were feeling pain. They're small. They're easily, you know, manipulated, maneuvered. And she started a public campaign, and it changed the way that we think about pain in children. The third myth is that children will always tell you that they're experiencing pain. And I've definitely found this to be true, that children don't always report when they're having pain. And there's a variety of reasons. They think that you should already know, right? Doctors, nurses, anyone, they should already know that they're having pain because you guys are the experts. They might want to go home. They're just like, I don't want to tell anybody about this because this is just going to make me either stay in the hospital longer or, you know, something's going to happen to me. Their fear of shots. There's some, you know, they're always worry that there's going to be something inflicted on them. And they're just not, they don't know what might happen. So they don't know, they're afraid of the consequences because they don't know what those consequences might be. Another myth is that opiates, so the narcotics, you know, we're talking about Vicodin, morphine, Dilaudid, all of those, Percocet, all of those opiates have too many side effects to use in kids. In kids that have severe pain, and especially in the hospital, they may need opiates. They may require opiates to really adequately treat their pain. Respiratory depression, so low breathing, is very rare if you dose it correctly. The GI or the gastrointestinal adverse effects like constipation can be prevented if you start them on a medication early to keep their stools soft. And then there's used to be this thought that you would mask the symptoms. So say you're trying to diagnose what's going on in a patient that comes into the emergency room. If you give them something like a dose of morphine, then you're not going to be able to, their pain's going to be gone, so then you can't figure out what's going on. They've done a lot of studies that show that actually this is not true. And they looked at patients that came in with symptoms that were suggestive of appendicitis. And they gave some patients opiates and some patients nothing or not a strong enough medication. And they found that the time to diagnosis was essentially the same, but the pain levels in this, in the, those that got the true opiate was much decreased. The other myth, especially with kids and also with adults, obviously, that opiates will cause addiction. So addiction, you know, is different from tolerance, which is different from dependence. And opiate addiction is a very rare consequence of pain management in kids. We very rarely see it. We definitely see kids that become more tolerant, and tolerant means they require more doses of the medication over time because their body sort of gets used to the medicine. But addiction, which is sort of a neuropsychosocial sort of thing where people have, they seek the drug out and have, that has negative consequences for their well-being, that we don't see in kids. In fact, I work on the palliative care service, so children that have chronic life-limiting diseases, we found that they actually may live longer with adequate pain treatment because they're much more comfortable and their pain is alleviated. And then there's this entity that we talk about sometimes called pseudo-addiction, where, you know, we're not treating their pain well enough, right? And so it's really undertreated initially. And so finally, when you start to treat them well, then they ask for more. And so people say, oh, they're definitely, they're drug-seeking. But actually, it's because in the beginning, you weren't actually treating their pain enough. So the importance of a good pain assessment. So it really helps to diagnose conditions, and it really helps to guide our pain management and what we're going to do for the patient. And it's something that patients and families should have. It should be a right, an expectation that everybody gets a good pain assessment. It's one of the greatest things that, you know, if you think about if your child's in the hospital, if your patient's sick, the one thing that you want to protect your child from is having increased pain or any kind of painful experience. And the more that we can do to prevent that, the better. And so it's very, very important that pain is addressed, it is assessed, and it's treated. So there's a lot of different ways that we use to address pain. We have to be very careful about how we interpret behaviors, as I said, with the myths. Sometimes being quiet is not going to be a good, reliable indicator. I always ask the parents, you know, obviously they know their child best. Do you think your child's in pain? You know, oftentimes the kid is not willing or is in too much pain to report. Heart rate, blood pressure, we sometimes use them. You know, if the heart rate's up, we say, oh, this child may be having more pain. But it's not always reliable. You have to take the whole picture. It is just one piece of the diagnostic tools that we use. So our selection of a pain assessment tool is really dependent on a lot of things: age, the developmental level of the child, the culture they come from, and if the pain is acute or chronic. This is a scale that we use for neonates. And so we look at crying, irritability, their behavior state, their facial expression, what their extremities look like, and then we also look at their vital signs. But we have to take all of these into account, and then we give them a score. And then this is the one we use for older kids. We look at their face, their legs, their activity, their cry, and their consolability. And we can sort of, we sort of scale it based on what they look like. And this has been shown in studies to be a pretty good indicator of how well the well-being of a child, the amount of pain that they're experiencing. And then older kids can actually tell me, I say, point to where your pain is on this line. Point to where your pain is on this line, this being the most pain, this being the no pain at all. Or the faces scales. And these are all, you know, kids can often really tell you, this is where I am. This is where I am. We look at their function. What are they doing? Are they able to play? Can they do their physical therapy? Are they interacting with their friends and with their family? So what about treatment options for kids? And I'm going to start with talking about your, you know, when you're treating a pain in any child with pain, you want to start with your evaluation. You want to treat the underlying causes. If a patient needs appendicitis because they're having right lower quadrant pain, obviously that's your treatment of choice. It's not just pain medications, but you want to treat whatever is causing that pain. If it's cancer, you want to treat the cancer. That's the second step. And then you want to use integrative therapies as much as possible. There's been a lot more acceptance of non-traditional, non-pharmacologic treatments for pain, and that's something that I do. I practice acupuncture on the inpatient setting, and we're really starting to embrace that there's a lot more to pain management than just medication. And then obviously drugs are going to be a part of the mainstay of your therapy as well. So this is the World Health Organization, and a lot of people sort of use this as a guide. So you want to start, for mild pain, you want to start with non-opioid analgesics. So this is your acetaminophens, your ibuprofens. And then if they're having more pain than that's able to be treated with this, then you go to your weak opioids. So opiates that are not as strong as, say, morphine, which is what I would call one of the parenteral potent opiates. So the weak opiates are things like oxycodone, hydrocodone. This is your Lortab, your Vicodins, and then your Percocets could go in this category as well. And then parenteral just means IV. So these are medicines that are usually given intravenously for patients in the hospital. And these are like your morphines, your fentanyl, Dilaudid. And that's for severe pain. And if you're having intractable pain, then sometimes we require more invasive therapies. You want to use the simplest method that does not cause pain. So with kids, we're very cognizant. We don't want to give a patient a shot for a pain, right? Because you're causing pain to treat their pain. So as much as we can avoid that, we try to avoid. And then obviously you want to reassess as often as possible to make sure you're doing a good job. You want pain to be, your goal is to get steady pain control. You don't want these ups and downs, these spikes and waves. You want to stay on top of the pain. So we call this, in the hospital, PRN means as needed. So they complain of pain, give them a pain med. That's not your ideal way of treating a patient that you know has constant pain. You want to give them enough around-the-clock medication so that they have this background level of pain control. And if they're having pain spikes, then you can give them another medication. And then this multimodal approach to pain treatment is our mainstay. So we don't, because if you're targeting the different pathways of how pain is transmitted, you don't want to just use one drug, because generally that drug just targets one of those in that pathway. You want to try and get to as many different of those pathways with your drugs as possible. So we always, people underuse acetaminophen. Tylenol is actually a really great pain reliever, and so is ibuprofen. And we use those in the hospital all the time. In fact, IV acetaminophen, IV Tylenol, is becoming much more commonly used, and it's a great drug. A lot of patients, they would prefer that because it doesn't cause a lot of the side effects as some of the opiates do. So you want to start with those, and then you layer on other medications, opiates if you need to, non-pharmacologic techniques. So you want to try to use as many different approaches to pain treatment as possible. So this is just a good sort of outline of what we're aiming for. So this is the amount of pain that a person's having. What you want to avoid, this is time during the day. You want to avoid these big spikes of pain kind of going up and then down and up and then down, where you want to keep your, you want to have a very steady background level of pain control that kind of keeps your pain control up in this higher area of analgesia, avoiding sedation. And this is pain right here. So, you know, all of these medications, especially the opiates, can cause over-sedation. So if you're just treating up and down, you're going to get times where the patient may become overly sedated. But if you're using good background control for their pain medicines, you're just going to keep them in this, it's gray shaded zone, which is what your goal is. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about some of the integrative therapies that we use for pain management. And I think that in conjunction with other therapies, they can be extremely, extremely effective. So integrative therapies, environmental. In the hospital, we have, you know, especially with kids, it's so important to try to make the environment as kid-friendly as possible. We focus on sort of art and music and room temperature, all of those things that can really make a difference and sometimes are very overlooked in the busy hospital environment. Physical methods, which I'll go into in a little bit, but cuddles, hugs, massage, comfort positioning, warms and cold packs, they can do a lot to help relieve pain. And then there's behavioral techniques, which I will talk about as well, biofeedback. Hypnosis is being used more and more. One of my roles is I'm a sedation doctor, so a lot of times we provide sedation for kids for painful type procedures, like IV placement and those kinds of things. And kids are so amenable to distraction and hypnosis that you can do so much with them. iPads, for example, all of our child life specialists have iPads, and you can get a kid playing Angry Birds for 15 minutes, and before you know it, whatever, the IV's in. So distraction can be really, really powerful as well. And then acupressure and acupuncture, and I'll talk about that a little bit as well. So swaddling, kangaroo wrapping, has been shown to decrease, we think, more anxiety and fear for kids that are going under painful procedures. The studies haven't really shown that they actually decrease pain when you're looking at neuroimaging, but you definitely see a decrease in the amount of cry that these kids have, their ability to be soothed. So especially in the nursery, we try to use cuddling and swaddling and massage as much as possible. And then another thing that's commonly used is nursing. You know, breastfeeding can be a great pain reliever, or decreasing, I guess, anxiety and fear around procedures. And then the use of sugar water. So we have sugar water that we dip the pacifiers into, and the neonates, the infants will suck on them, and it's very, very soothing to them. So that's the picture. You know, in the nursery, the babies have to get their newborn screens. They have to have a lot of heel sticks sometimes. Some children get circumcised, and oftentimes this is part of their treatment for pain. Is not the only thing, but using a pacifier dipped in some sugar water can be very helpful. Art, music, and pet therapy. We use this in the hospital a lot, and it's extremely useful in kids. It's been shown to decrease heart rate, blood pressure, respiratory rate. It decreases stress and anxiety in the hospital. It significantly decreases isolation. Kids report less pain. And it really is, a lot of times in the hospital, patients need to go through physical therapy, and pets can be one of the great motivators for kids. And you'll see kids do things that they won't do unless the dog is in the room, and you can really see progress. So these are just pictures in the hospital of kids that are getting music therapy. You can see that they're moving their limbs and their arms. They're using their creative side, and it really can be extremely, extremely helpful. And then pet therapy. We have two dogs on our just dedicated to our pediatric service. And, you know, they've accompanied kids to the pre-op area in the operating room. They come into the sedation rooms, and really they've become great tools that we use in the hospital. So mind-body techniques. Mind-body techniques are like your biofeedback, meditation. And these are techniques that facilitate a person's own ability to direct their own behavior and modulate physiologic changes in a desired direction for the purpose of symptom control and maintaining health and wellness. So really what this does is just put a conscious awareness on our own internal ability to modulate our response to things like pain. If you practice yoga or meditation, you're practicing a mind-body technique. And I think it's really important in the hospital, you know, especially for physicians. We're so used to being sort of prescribing things, telling patients what to do. This is your treatment plan. And really this puts the focus back on the patient and gives them sort of the sense of control. A lot of times, especially with kids, you know, they feel this loss of control when they're sick. And if you can give them some tools that they can learn to help modulate their own responses to pain, it can be such a powerful thing. And kids actually have this very natural drive that they want to master something. Show me something, I want to do it. I want to, you know, a challenge. They like that. And so if you present it to them that way, then they can, some of these kids just really embrace it. These are just some of the conditions that I think mind-body techniques are really amenable for. And there's been a lot of data on most on these that I listed here to sort of that it does help. One thing I will say is the best time to learn these techniques is not when they're having an acute pain crisis. The best time to learn these techniques is when they're feeling relatively well. But it's sort of something that they can practice and they can learn. It's sort of like exercising, and then they can use it. It's a tool in their tool belt that they can use when they're having an acute pain episode. Biofeedback is a mind-body technique. And basically what happens is that you have a computer and there's wires that are attached to the computer that are hooked up to the body. And the body, what it measures is things like muscle tension, your heart rate variability. It can measure your oxygenation. And all of that data is fed into a computer. And the data, the computer will print it out either as a graph, or with kids, it can be a video game or a picture. So there's all these different programs. And then what happens is you learn to attune to and modulate this data. So one of the things we have is a video game where there's a hot air balloon on the screen. And if the kids learn to modulate their breathing, modulate their heart rate, and they can get the balloon to sort of travel through different parts of us, you know, out of a video screen. And so it's a very powerful sort of visual way that kids can learn how to, or anybody can learn how to change some of these physiologic things that are being monitored by these sensors. HeartMath is one of the ones that we use. It's a specific device used in our hospital. And what it measures is heart rate variability, which is also called coherence. And we found that in newborns, heart rate variability, or the degree that your heart rate will change with stimuli, like, you know, if there's something exciting, your heart rate will go up. And then if you're more rested, your heart rate will go down. How well you have this variability. It's a sign and it's a good predictor of illness in kids. And it's something that you can learn how to modulate. And this is available as a handheld device, as a computer game, and kids can learn how to change their heart rate variability, and it can have very good effects. And kids feel this overall sensation of decreased stress, decreased anxiety. Acupuncture. So acupuncture is a part of Chinese medicine, and it basically is the primary concept is that of qi. And qi is thought of as this energy or life force that runs through the body, and it circulates in pathways, specific pathways called meridians. And if you have free-flowing qi, and if you're very in vigorous qi, then you're healthy. But if you have insufficient qi, or somehow that qi is blocked or interrupted, that's when illness occurs. And acupuncture works by tapping into these specific meridians with needles, and therefore freeing up the blocked qi or increasing the amount of qi that's flowing through these pathways. It's become much more popular. I'm sure that's no surprise to anyone here. Right now in the U.S., there's over 6,000 doctors and about 12,000 non-doctors that practice acupuncture. And the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture trains about 600 physicians a year. And the Osher Center here has a very robust acupuncture practice. And then on the inpatient side, there are more and more physicians that are doing acupuncture. How do we think it might work? Well, we do know that it helps to assist in the release of neurotransmitters. So all of those inhibitory, endogenous opiates that we talk about, there's endorphins, enkephalins, serotonin. It helps to modulate the release of those, and it can inhibit the transmission of pain. There was one pretty good study where they looked at patients that were getting a dental procedure done, and they either had them, then they all got acupuncture for their to treat their pain. But then afterwards, some of them got just water, saline, and some of them got this drug called naloxone. And naloxone is a drug that directly blocks the effect of an opiate. And those patients that got the naloxone had an increase, a very rapid shot increase of their pain. So that sort of suggests that it's modulated by opiates, because the naloxone, which typically blocks opiates, had a much more marked effect in those that had the naloxone infusion as opposed to those who just got normal saline. For migraines, it's been shown to be very, very effective. This study was a pretty small study, but it was pretty powerful. They showed that they had the 43 kids, and they randomized them to either get real acupuncture or sham acupuncture. And sham acupuncture, basically, they put needles in the patients, but not in true acupuncture points, so not along a meridian. And they got weekly treatments, and they showed that those that had the real acupuncture had very clear reductions in their migraine frequency and the severity of their headaches. It's also great for nausea and vomiting. This study looked at patients that were getting a tonsillectomy, so they had to get a surgical procedure, and they were randomly assigned to get real acupuncture, sham acupuncture, or a control. And the needles were actually placed when they were under anesthesia, so they didn't know what they were getting. And then they wrapped their arms so that the patients couldn't see which group they were put in. And then they found that the degree of postoperative nausea and vomiting was significantly less in those that got acupuncture. So, but this was the one, the light gray, these patients had true acupuncture. The crisscross ones were the ones that had sham acupuncture, and then the controls. And this is sort of the incidence of nausea was much lower in those that had true acupuncture, incidence of vomiting, their need for rescue medications, so their need for an antiemetic, and then PONV is their postoperative nausea and vomiting. Their postoperative nausea and vomiting was significantly less in the group that had true acupuncture. So this is something that I use a lot when I do sedations. I can do a little bit of acupressure along the points for nausea and vomiting, and I think it really helps to reduce their need for medication afterwards. You know, some of these medications have side effects, and you know, the less amount of med that you need, this is a very safe, benign procedure that can be done, the better. A lot of people ask me, how can you do needles in kids? You know, acupuncture for kids, that's crazy. Well, for one thing, I think that if you talk to children about what you're doing and give them, I sit with the kids for a long period of time telling them what to do. I demonstrate on myself. I'll demonstrate on the parents if they let me. And, you know, the actual needle, I don't know if any of you have had acupuncture, but it doesn't really hurt once it goes in. A lot of times kids are like, oh, is it in already? It just feels like a tiny little pinch and it's done. I also don't have to use needles, so I have a laser that I can use, and that degree sort of, it just sort of transmits a low level of light transmission to the acupuncture points. It doesn't hurt and can be effective, as well as using some magnets and beads that can also help along those points. So now I'm going to talk about some of the medications that are used to treat pain. Again, I want to just kind of remind you of this treatment step ladder that we use. So we start with mild pain. We try to use the non-opiates. If you're having moderate pain, we want to use a weak opiate through the oral route. And then if you're having more severe pain, then we're going to go to stronger opiates through the IV route. And then if there's intractable pain, you may have to go to some more invasive procedures. So Tylenol, acetaminophen, it's a very effective centrally acting analgesic. We don't actually know the mechanism of action. We think it's a COX-2 inhibitor. And so I'll go over exactly what that means when we describe a drug as being a COX-2 inhibitor. It's not a great anti-inflammatory drug, so it's not as good as, say, the naprosins or the ibuprofens for treating inflammation, like joint swelling. But it is a very good analgesic. The problem with acetaminophen for kids is that it's often dosed incorrectly. And that's partly because there's so many different concentrations available on the market. And if you walk down any pharmacy aisle, you look at about the number of medications with Tylenol in it for kids. It's amazing. It's combined with other medications. It's really confusing for parents. And the labeling is confusing. So these are all Tylenol. And so people, you know, parents, how are you supposed to know? This is, you know, this is all acetaminophen is the actual generic name, but it's also described as APAP. It can be listed as N-acetyl-P-aminophenol. Paracetamol is a European word language that they use, and then obviously Tylenol. So it's confusing. There's been some movement to sort of help regulate this a little bit more, to make this more standardized, to decrease the number of concentrations. You know, for infants, there's a much stronger, you know, the drops are much more concentrated, and then there's this liquid syrup, which is not as concentrated. So sometimes parents think, oh, I'll just use the drop, but they don't know that it's a stronger concentration, so they're giving their kids a lot more. And the problem with acetaminophen is that it can cause severe liver toxicity if it's used in very large doses. So we try to make sure that parents are understanding of this, especially in the very young children. You want to be very careful about using Tylenol and making sure that people are using the correct doses. So NSAIDs. NSAID stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And you'll often hear this referred to a lot. So NSAIDs, these are very effective analgesics, so pain relievers. They're effective antipyretics, which is a fever reducer. And they're also anti-inflammatory. So that's how it differs from your acetaminophens. And basically, they cause a reversible blockade of the COX enzyme. And I'll go through that pathway in just a second. It's a great reliever for mild to moderate pain, and it's often combined with opiates. So if you use that multimodal approach that I talked about, using combination drug therapy, you can see a decrease in the total amount of opiate that a patient might use. And that's oftentimes our big goal, because opiates are effective, but they have a lot of side effects. And so if you can decrease the amount of opiates that a patient is using, they can stay on those medications for a much longer period of time. So this is the COX pathway. So the COX pathway, there are two enzymes. There's COX-1 and COX-2. COX-1 is basically its constitutive, which means it's always in action in the body. And it's found in the stomach, the kidneys, the intestines, the platelets. And what it happens is it modulates sort of some physiologic functions. And so it's a necessary part of our functioning. And this is COX-2, and it's known as an inducible enzyme, which means that it requires some sort of inflammatory stimulus to get into action. And what happens is it causes inflammation, and it causes this release of all of these inflammatory prostaglandins, proteases, causing more inflammation. And so NSAIDs generally will block both COX-2 and COX-1. But the problem is, when you block the COX-1, you're blocking some of these physiologic functions that are necessary. And one of the big ones is bleeding and platelet aggregation. So it can promote bleeding and ulcers is in the stomach, right? So if you're taking something orally, if it blocks the COX-1, then you're going to get risk of bleeding in the stomach and GI irritation. What you really want is a drug that selectively inhibits the COX-2 enzyme. And we have some that are more COX-2 inhibitors than COX-1, but we haven't found that perfect drug yet. And I know there was a lot of recently, there were a couple of drugs that were put on that were kind of advertised as being selective COX-2 inhibitors, but then they were found to have other side effects that were not desirable. And so we're getting there, but I think that this is really what you want to target. You want to target just the COX-2, because if you can decrease inflammation, decrease this pathway, then you're getting a significant decrease in pain, inflammation. So these are your non-steroidals, ibuprofen, which is the same as Motrin, the same as Advil. So if you're taking both Motrin and Advil, you're taking the same exact drug. Naprosyn is also known as Aleve. And then we have a drug that's available IV that's called Toradol. And Toradol is basically an IV form of ibuprofen. All of these have renal toxicity, so they affect the kidneys, and they also can have gastrointestinal adverse effects, so acute gastrointestinal bleeding, leading to, you know, ulcers, that kind of stuff. Tramadol. So I don't know if anyone has ever heard of Tramadol, but it's one of the newer drugs that we've been using a lot. It's not an opiate, but it does have some opiate effects. We don't know fully how it works, but it's a great drug for the treatment of moderate pain. And it's given orally, which is nice. And it doesn't have a lot of the side effect profile that we often see with other opiates. So not as much respiratory depression, not as much constipation. And it can also have some help for neuropathic type pain. So this is a drug that we've been using a lot for kids that have moderate amount of pain. So opioids. Opioids are one of the world's oldest known drugs. As you know, it's part of the, comes from poppy seeds, poppy flower. And how it works is it decreases your perception of pain. So it acts centrally and it decreases your reaction to pain and increases your pain tolerance. It can sort of lead to this feeling of euphoria and sense of well-being. Opioids, they bind to very specific opioid receptors in the nervous system. So this is the morphine, for example. It'll bind to this receptor. And the amount that it binds and how well it likes this receptor will determine how effective it is. So some, like morphine, has a very strong affinity to this opiate receptor, so it can cause significant pain relief. Others have, others don't bind quite as strongly, and so you may have less of an effect. And when it binds to this receptor, this is what leads to the decreased amount of pain, decreased pain transmission, and it causes the sense of euphoria. And this happens both in the brain and in the spinal cord. So opiates for moderate pain. So there's two main drugs that we use. One is hydrocodone. And hydrocodone always comes combined with acetaminophen. So you can't get hydrocodone on its own. It just doesn't, it's not marketed that way. And this is your Vicodins, your Lortabs, and your Norco is another one. And then they're only given orally. So this, there's no IV form. And then there's your oxycodone. So oxycodone you can get by itself as a single drug or in combination with acetaminophen or Tylenol. And that's your Percocets, your Roxasets. Those are your moderate opiates. And then for severe pain, can be given oral or IV. We have morphine, hydromorphone, which is dilaudid, fentanyl, and methadone. And they don't have to be just oral or IV. Some of these comes in a variety of different forms that I'll kind of touch on. And then you have your long-acting opioids. So these are your Emiskaten, your Hydromorph cotton, and your Oxycontins. So these are they're for moderate pain, but they're meant for patients with chronic pain. You really shouldn't start a patient on Oxycontin or something like that because they're very strong opiates. They only have to be taken twice a day. They're sustained release. So you take them orally, and they act over a long period of time, just kind of giving you a steady amount of pain control. They can be very, very effective. It is becoming much more of a kind of a street drug. You know, people will crush them or use them in ways that will give them more of a big rush of pain relief and euphoria. And so they should never be crushed or chewed. They have to be swallowed. Oh, I was going to talk a little bit. So fentanyl, I just wanted to mention, fentanyl is one of the drugs that we use a lot. It's a synthetic opioid. And one of the nice things about fentanyl, it comes in a variety of different forms. There's a patch that we can use that delivers it through the skin. There's actually an oralette, so like a little lollipop that kids can kind of suck on to help give them pain relief. And morphine and dilaudid also come in the IV oral form as well. So codeine. Codeine, we're kind of getting away from the use of codeine, and there's a couple of reasons why. One is that it has to be metabolized to morphine first in order to get its analgesic effect. So sometimes you're not getting as much of an analgesic effect as if you were to use some of the other drugs. And it has a lot of active metabolites. So once it's metabolized, it has a lot bigger side effect profile. So it can cause people to feel lousy, more nausea, they're dysphoric, their mood is not good. And then there's about 10% of the population that just can't metabolize a drug. And it's hard to predict who those people are, but they'll tell you they take a codeine and it doesn't do anything for them. And then there's about 1% to 2% of the population that are really rapid metabolizers. And so they're much more prone to getting overdosing from just normal doses of codeine. So it's just a really variable effect, and it's hard to predict which patients are going to have good control with codeine and which ones aren't. So we've kind of gotten away from using codeine. And then Demerol is another one that we've kind of gotten away from using because it is it can cause significant neurotoxicity if it's used over time. So it can cause seizures, tremors, myoclonus, and we've gotten away from using it in the inpatient setting. PCAs are something we use a lot in the hospital. So PCAs, it's a little button that you can push, and it gives you can give yourself a dose of the medication. We use it, adults use it, it's very common to use it. You can do it just with the push, or you can also deliver as continuous infusion and then also have the button to push. Generally, we say that kids that are more than 6 years of age can independently use the PCA. Some younger kids can also learn how to push it appropriately, but at our hospital, we don't allow the parents to use the PCA to push the button for the kids. I think there's just a safety profile. It's unclear sometimes, if we want to make sure that the kids are expressing pain before the button is pushed. But it can be very, very helpful in kids that are undergoing surgical procedures postoperatively. A PCA can be an extremely good way to deliver opiates. These are some common opiate side effects. And nausea and vomiting is very common with opiates. We see a lot of people just feel really sick to their stomach. Constipation is very common. And really, anybody that's on an opiate should be on a stool softener. We kind of have this saying, it's like the hand that writes the order for the opiate without writing for the stool softener is also the hand that's going to do the disimpaction when the patient comes in and can't stool. So we really stress you have to start something because constipation is extremely common. Itchiness is very common. Patients their nose will be really itchy and they feel very uncomfortable. If you have too high a dose, it can cause some confusion, sedation, and an even higher dose, more of a side effect would be the respiratory depression, and rarely you can have an allergic reaction to the opiates. Some patients tell me I'd rather have the pain than the side effects. So sometimes these are much more, especially the itchiness, can be just really, really bothersome for a lot of patients. And we have things that we can do to treat it, but, oftentimes just taking, the treatment is really just changing to a different drug. So what about this neuropathic pain that we talked about before? So again, just to review, this is the pain signal going up into the brain, and then these are the inhibitory pathways. And with neuropathic pain, you have this increased sensitivity of these nerves here and an increased hyperexcitability of this receptor in the dorsal root ganglion. So this nerve right here is just extremely sensitive to any kind of neural transmission. And so we have drugs that will specifically target this receptor that will decrease this hyperexcitability, so decrease some of the pathologic nerve function and help to improve pain. For neuropathic pain, there's really no single treatment that works for all neuropathic pain. And I usually tell patients, any one of these drugs that we choose, there's a 50% chance that it's going to cause some kind of relief. There's some patients that respond really well and some that have no effect whatsoever from the drug. So it's really frustrating for patients. They've gone through a whole litany of different kind of medications, and sometimes you just don't have the right combination. This is a long-term problem. You have to follow them very carefully as an outpatient. We have all kinds of drugs that we can use. Antidepressants are actually really good to treat neuropathic pain. Amitriptyline, nortriptyline, these are all different kinds of antidepressant drugs that we use. The anti-seizure medications are actually also very good pain medications for neuropathic pain. One of the ones that we use a lot is gabapentin, and then pregabalin, which is Lyrica, is another drug that we commonly use, and this targets the NMDA receptor. Opiates can be used if it's used for acute pain crises in patients that have neuropathic pain. It can help, but oftentimes it's just very sedating, and it's not a long-term solution for patients with neuropathic pain. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these other treatment modalities that we use. local and topical anesthetics. So I think this is, there's some really neat things that are coming out for the treatment of sort of procedural type pain. So Emla and Elamex, it's a cream, it's like a numbing medicine that we use, and sometimes you can put it over an area that's specifically causing pain and it can basically numb it up. The Sanera patch is also sort of a little Band-Aid thing that will deliver lidocaine and numbing medicine directly into the skin. There's a powder. So this uses sort of a compressed gas that kind of shoots into the through the skin of a powder form of a anesthetic agent. And this we use for patients that need to have IVs placed in the hospital. And then there's this thing called the shot blocker. So the shot blocker basically uses this gate control theory of pain management. So it's this little plastic, it's very, it kind of ingenious. It's this little plastic thing. And on the one side, it has these little nubbins sticking out there, a little bit sharp, but not painful. And you place it over the area that you're going to give the injection or the shot to. And what it does is it saturates all of these sensory signals around where the shot's going to be giving. And it sort of distracts the pain signals that are caused by the needle poke. And so it can be really sort of, you know, it's sort of like, I think about like if you have a mosquito bite and it's really, really itchy, if you cause sort of like, if you push on it or push some pain stimuli there, it actually will decrease the itchiness because it's sort of distracting. The pain fibers are distracted and you have a decrease. You can have a decrease in the amount of pain that you feel. Topical lidocaine. So the lidocaine patch is another great thing for local type of pain. It's available as a gel and a patch, and it can be fitted to fit the area that's having a significant amount of pain. And it's been shown to have a good effect for peripheral and neuropathic pain. And it isn't absorbed as much systemically or through the rest of the body, so not as much side effects. Capsaicin is one of the other things that's being used more and more often. It is obviously the things that's found in chili peppers, the really hot, you know, the burning sensation that you feel or you can have after you eat a pepper or if you rub your eyes. This is what we use, and basically it depletes something called substance P, which is important in pain transmission. And they found that if you administer for patients that have neuropathic pain, generally it's a patch that's put on, you can significantly decrease the amount of pain that they have. It does cause some local skin irritation, and in the beginning it actually causes more pain, but then over time it can cause a significant decrease in the pain. Ketamine. So ketamine is another very powerful drug that's used a lot in the emergency rooms for sedation when patients need fractures set or procedures done. It's what we call a dissociative anesthetic. So it's basically, it puts patients in a trance-like state. When I put patients under on ketamine, you can see them, their eyes are awake and they're looking around, but you can do anything to them that's painful and they don't feel it. They're basically dissociated from the painful procedure. If you use it in very low doses, it can actually be very potent analgesic. And so we use it a lot with patients with a lot of severe refractory neuropathic pain. And especially when they're requiring really large doses of an opioid, then if you use it in conjunction with the ketamine, you can gradually decrease the amount of opiates, gradually decrease the amount of side effects that they're getting from that opiate. It's a street drug. It's called Special K or something like that on the street. So it's definitely, because it's a hallucinogenic, really, at high doses, it can be used as a, it's a hallucinogenic. So regional anesthesia. Regional anesthesia is used for patients with intractable, sort of localized pain. And this is what, you know, I don't personally perform, it's done by our anesthesiologists, but it can be used as an adjunct to all the other treatment modalities that we've talked about. So there's epidural infusions, you can get spinal analgesia, and there's very sort of focused nerve blocks. And this is just sort of, you know, this is dermatomes. So we call dermatomes a wet nerve innervates sort of what part of the body. And so if you can block, like if you know that a patient has severe pain right here, if you can block this nerve transmission, then you can get just sort of localized pain relief. And so you want to figure out which nerve you want to target. So regional anesthetic usually involves a needle and then a catheter to infuse it. And then you can also sometimes use ultrasound to kind of make sure that you're in the right spot. So this is a stellate ganglion block, so you're blocking the stellate nerve. And this can be used for patients. It basically anesthetizes the neck and the shoulder and the hand, you know, this upper extremity, and then also some parts of the face. It's often used for patients that have really severe pain from like herpes zoster or local musculoskeletal pain. They can use it for that as well. And you're basically targeting just one nerve, and you want to just numb that nerve with some sort of local anesthetic. Epidural infusion. So the epidural infusion, obviously, it's a commonly used when in labor and delivery, but it can give you very good pain relief without having to go under general anesthesia. And we often use it for patients that have sort of localized pain or undergoing a surgical procedure. And what happens is, so this is the epidural space in yellow, and it kind of bathes the spinal cord, and we call it a potential space because it's a space that is there, and you can use it, and there's fluid that's sort of in that space, and this is where you're targeting to get your analgesic and your local anesthetic. So what they do is they basically put in a needle into this epidural space, and then they instill this solution. This is what they can do for if you're doing a spinal anesthesia. And then if you're doing an epidural, you're going to actually thread a catheter into this space, and you leave the catheter in, you take the needle out, and then you can deliver the medication into this potential space, causing sort of local regional anesthesia. And so you can see here that's with the medicine infused. It goes, surrounds the entire spinal cord. Okay, what about future treatment strategies? So really, there are sort of a few things that are on the horizon. One is better drugs, so targeted therapies to specific receptors. There are different receptors, different ion channels that are responsible for pain transmission and for pain perception. And if we can actually target those, then you can get improved pain relief without all of the side effects. Gene therapy. So someday we'll be able to map out the specific genetic makeup of an individual person and figure out what would be best for them based on their genetic makeup, their genotype, to treat their pain. And then improve diagnostics. So ways, you know, the imaging is sort of the window into the brain, neuroimaging. We have PET scans, we have MRIs, and all of these can help to improve and help us figure out chronic pain states and sort of in real time figure out if we're getting a response to our treatment. So gene therapy, I just want to talk about. So that we've now know that our sensation of pain and response to therapy can be greatly affected by our genotype. We know that women are generally more sensitive to pain, have lower pain thresholds than men. And then there's also this study with looking at hair color. And so we know that people with red hair have a variation in a certain type of gene. It's like melanocortin 2 or something. And it's been anecdotally noted that these patients in dental procedures actually require more anesthesia. They're not as, those local anesthetics don't work as well for them. And it's probably based on some difference in the same gene that's causing the red hair is also causing them to have sort of a sensitivity to pain. So in the horizon, if we are figuring all this information out, we may be able to target those specific genes and figure out therapies that will work better for each individual person. So there's a lot of information. And I had a very, very long list of different references for you guys, some websites that you can log on to, and different books that you can use. So I will take any questions that you guys might have. Thank you. You know, I think that's a hard one. I think it's really, sometimes it's hard to get that information out of kids, right? Because they don't necessarily, especially depending on their developmental stage, they may not have the language to really express sort of the amount of pain that they're in. One thing that we use a lot is you can use dolls or use something else. So take sort of the focus away from them, and they may be able to sort of model with other things what kind of pain they're having, and be able to better describe it. You know, also just sort of, you know, how old did you say, a second grader? Yeah. I think sometimes, you know, the level of activity and what they want to do. And if you know your child really well, it can give you an idea of, I guess, how severe or should, you know, I guess, you know, as a parent, I'm the same. I have a first grader and a fifth grader. It's sort of like, do I take this seriously? You know, how concerned do I need to be? And I think that's always sort of the question in your mind. Do I take this, you know, and I go through that too. Should I take him to the emergency room, or should I, is this like something for their pediatrician? Is this something for, you know, more acutely? And so I think it's sometimes difficult, but I think, you know, one is sort of having them sort of looking at their level of activity and what they're wanting to do is one thing. And then also, if you want them to sort of be more expressive about it, maybe having them describe it in sort of not focused on themselves so much. Not all hospitals. I think most academic hospitals will have a pain clinic, and a lot of hospitals do these days. I think the resources and what's available to a pain clinic really varies. And, you know, in my mind, a really good pain clinic will have a lot of different resources that people can tap into. So, you know, you would ideally like to have someone, obviously, with knowledge in pharmacologic drugs, but also the ability to do some of the more interventional modalities, as well as sort of the non-pharmacologic, so to have acupuncture. And then one thing that's really huge is just sort of the psychological aspects of pain and the effect that it has on functioning and depression. I think, you know, almost for all our patients that have chronic pain, we really recommend them to have some sort of counseling or just something to be able to talk, not to say that they have a diagnosis of any kind of mental illness, but it's just a natural part of having to deal with pain all the time, is to have a psychological or some sort of, in kids, some sort of behavioral intervention or therapy or some guidance for parents. You know, to be honest, I don't think it's hugely effective. I mean, I think what I focus on when I do acupuncture for neuropathic pain is really overall stress and anxiety sort of relief, and I focus on some of the points that I know work for that. Sometimes if it's a really significant sort of localized neuropathic type pain, sometimes doing pointed acupressure around that area can be helpful. And again, I think it kind of goes along the whole lines of distraction of the nerves that are causing the pain can help cause, it can give you some intermittent relief. You know, patients feel in general much more relaxed and then decreased pain, but it's not necessarily sustained over a long period of time. But some patients, you know, once they start doing acupuncture, you need to have pretty regular, at least, you know, every couple of weeks to have another session done. And so we have outpatient resources that we can refer patients to. Of course, yes. If you are treating, I mean, and, you know, I'm also the, you know, like, people get really freaked out when patients aren't a large number, you know, really high dose of an opiate. But, you know, patients may need a really large, very high dose that you would not expect to treat their pain. And that's very, very appropriate. Everyone's different. And over time, you do develop what we call tolerance. So, you know, the nerve basically gets, your body gets used to the amount of drug that it's been getting, and it may require increasing dosages to achieve the same level of pain relief. And so, you know, there's a difference between tolerance and dependence and addiction. And so, you know, tolerance means that you have a physiologic, no, dependence means you have a physiologic sort of need for that drug. And so if you took that drug away, you may experience significant withdrawal effects, right? So patients get very sweaty, they get very anxious, they can get, their heart rate can go up, they just feel really lousy, they can get really nauseous. All of those things are withdrawal because their body has become dependent on a drug. That's different from addiction. You can be dependent on a drug without being addicted to it. So a good example is like high blood pressure medicine. Some people are really dependent on their high blood pressure medicine. If they don't get their high blood pressure medicine, their body has physiologic changes. They experience physiologic changes when they don't have it, headaches or whatever it is. So that's a dependence on the drug, but they're not addicted to it. They don't change their lifestyle. They don't change their behaviors. There's no negative consequences from their drug-seeking behaviors that have occurred because of their dependence on the medication. And then you can also be addicted to a drug without being dependent on it. So patients that are, for example, addicted to cocaine, you don't go through any significant withdrawal symptoms when you don't have the cocaine. You may get depressed, your mood may change, but that's not the same as a physiological sort of your body's response to not having that drug. That's not what happens often with cocaine. That's more of an addiction. Your behavior changes, your lifestyle changes, the way that it's an environmental, it's a psychosocial, it's a lot more elements are involved with true addiction. There's a genetic component than when you're talking about dependence on a drug. Well, thank you guys.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.